Imagine being bound by a marriage contract you never signed, pursued relentlessly by a man who kills without remorse, yet loves with fierce devotion. This is the world of T.L. Smith's Lethal Vows, a dark romance that has captivated readers worldwide with its exploration of dangerous desire and impossible choices. The novel has developed a cult following among readers who enjoy the mafia romance subgenre, with book talk influencers praising its perfect balance of danger and passion. What makes this story particularly compelling is how it challenges our moral compass. We find ourselves rooting for characters whose actions would horrify us in real life, creating that delicious cognitive dissonance that makes dark romance so addictive. As one reviewer put it, Smith makes you fall in love with the villain and question your own moral boundaries. In the sweltering heat of Rome, 16-year-old Rhea Ricci navigates the ancient cobblestone streets with the practiced grace of someone who understands the weight of legacy. The Ricci name opens doors and closes conversations, a double-edged sword she's wielded since childhood. People acknowledge her with respectful nods before quickly averting their eyes, a dance of deference and fear that marks her as untouchable. The daughter of one of Italy's most powerful crime families learns early that even casual interactions carry the burden of generations of carefully cultivated power. During a seemingly ordinary afternoon at a local cafe, Rhea meets her childhood friend Angel, who introduces her to two men who will irreversibly alter the course of her life, Crewe Monty and his brother Dominic. Crewe, with his sharp features and predatory grace, immediately commands attention. His dark eyes hold secrets that seem to mock the world around him, while Dominic maintains a quieter, more watchful presence. The group shares a bottle of Brunello di Montalcino, its rich notes matching the intensity of the unspoken tension between Rhea and Crewe. Their conversation flows with dangerous ease until Rhea, emboldened by wine and youth, confides her plans to escape to New York, a desperate bid to avoid an arranged marriage she wants no part of. Crewe's response cuts through the warm afternoon air like ice. He reveals himself as her intended husband, the man her father had chosen years ago. With a casualness that belies the gravity of his words, Crewe establishes the terms of their future. If she isn't married by 34, he'll claim what he considers his birthright. When Rhea challenges him, asking about potential marriage to another, his response carries the weight of generations of violence. That would be bad for your husband. Words delivered with such conviction that they haunt her dreams for years to come. 14 years later, Rhea has carved out an impressive career as a criminal defense attorney in New York. Her corner office overlooks Manhattan, a daily reminder of how far she's come from the suffocating expectations of her family. But on her 30th birthday, as she celebrates with colleagues at an upscale restaurant, the carefully constructed walls of her new life crumble. Crewe appears like a specter from her past, his greeting of princess dripping with dark promise. Without hesitation, he draws a gun and executes her boss, a message written in blood that her time of freedom is ending. The police write off the murder as a closed case, another casualty in the endless dance of organized crime. But Rhea knows this is just the opening move in a game she's been dreading for 14 years. When she returns to her apartment, she finds Crewe waiting in her living room, as comfortable as if he owns the space, and, by extension, her. Despite years of martial arts training, countless hours of kickboxing and jiu-jitsu that helped her feel in control, she discovers that physical prowess means little against his overwhelming force. It's a harsh reminder that their power dynamic extends far beyond mere physical strength, reaching into the shadows of family obligations and blood-sworn contracts that have bound their fates together since before she could understand their meaning. Crewe Monty is not a man who takes no for an answer. Born into one of Italy's most notorious crime families, he was trained from childhood to be ruthless and uncompromising. His first kill came at 12 years old, when his father forced him to execute their bodyguard for alleged betrayal, a formative moment that would shape his understanding of loyalty and power. The bodyguard had been like an uncle to young Crew, making the execution particularly devastating. By 20, Crew had murdered his own father, torturing him in the same room where he'd been forced to commit his first murder years earlier, bringing a poetic justice to his childhood trauma. The Monty legacy runs deep in his veins. "I have all the titles passed down from generation to generation," Crew reflects with a mix of pride and bitterness. "I was trained from a young age to be ruthless, and that's exactly what I'll be, even against a little princess." His education in violence was thorough, from weapons training at age 6 to learning the intricacies of psychological warfare by 15. His obsession with Rhea isn't merely about honoring a contract between families. For reasons even he doesn't fully comprehend, she has occupied his thoughts since their first meeting at a family gathering 3 years ago. Her defiance fascinated him, a quality rare in their world of automatic compliance. While in New York, Crew is simultaneously reclaiming territory that rightfully belongs to his family and pursuing the woman he believes should be his wife. Each move is calculated, each strategy designed to bring him closer to both objectives. What makes Crew such a fascinating character is the contradiction between his brutal methods and his unwavering devotion to Rhea. He kills without hesitation, threatens those she cares about, and manipulates circumstances to force her compliance. Yet he also displays a vulnerability with her that he shows no one else. In private moments, his hands shake when he touches her, and his voice softens from its usual steel edge. When his brother Dominic questions whether Rhea must be the one he marries, suggesting more politically advantageous matches, Crew's response is unequivocal. "I know it could be anyone else, but it has always been her. Rhea Ritchie will be my wife." This declaration reveals both his determination and the depth of his fixation, a rare crack in his otherwise impenetrable armor. Behind closed doors, Crew maintains a private collection of surveillance photos of Rhea spanning years, each carefully dated and preserved. His obsession manifests in knowing every detail of her life, her favorite coffee shop, her jogging route, even the name of her childhood pet. This attention to detail makes him both a more effective predator and, paradoxically, someone who understands her better than anyone else in her life. The chemistry between Rhea and Crew is explosive from their first reunion. Despite her determination to resist him, Rhea finds herself drawn to his dangerous allure. Their interactions are characterized by a push-pull dynamic. She defies him at every turn, yet cannot deny the powerful attraction between them. During a dinner where Crew attempts to assert his dominance by ordering food she doesn't like, Rhea deliberately challenges him by refusing to eat. When she discovers that her friend Monica has been spying on her for her father, she storms out of the restaurant, only to be cornered by Crew, who insists they will marry. In a moment of desperation, she bites his cheek hard enough to draw blood, an act that, surprisingly, seems to excite rather than anger him. This pattern repeats throughout their relationship. Rhea constantly tests Crew's boundaries, arriving late to meetings despite his warnings, dating other men against his explicit instructions, and refusing to acknowledge his claim on her. Each defiance is met with escalating possessiveness from Crew, who eliminates any man who shows interest in her and repeatedly marks her as his property, both figuratively and literally, with a Tobiera ankle bracelet bearing his initial. Their sexual encounters are as combative as they are passionate. During a dinner at Crew's apartment, Rhea discovers his gun and impulsively pulls the trigger, causing someone to scream. Rather than being angered, Crew is aroused by her boldness. They end up having sex on the dining table so intensely that knocked-over candles start a fire, with sprinklers activating overhead while Rhea holds Crew's own knife to his throat. "My dangerous bitch," he whispers admiringly as they reach climax together. This dangerous dance exemplifies the central tension of their relationship. Rhea craves the freedom and independence she's fought hard to achieve, while Crew demands complete submission and ownership. Yet paradoxically, it is only with Crew that Rhea feels truly free to express her darkest desires and impulses. Both Rhea and Crew inhabit worlds where power is currency, and both wield their respective forms of power with expertise. As a successful criminal defense attorney, Rhea has learned to manipulate truth in courtrooms to protect her clients, just as her mother manipulated people to get what she wanted. "We're both calculators," Rhea reflects about her relationship with her mother. "She calculates people to get what she wants, and I calculate the truth in courtrooms to defend my clients." This parallel between mother and daughter reveals how early experiences shaped Rhea's understanding of power and influence. Rhea's courtroom prowess isn't just about legal knowledge, it's about understanding human nature. She reads juries like chess pieces, anticipates prosecutors' strategies, and crafts narratives that blur the lines between victim and perpetrator. Her success rate is legendary in Chicago's legal circles, earning her both admiration and resentment from colleagues who whisper that she's too good at defending the indefensible. Crew's power is more direct, but no less calculated. He systematically eliminates obstacles, forms strategic alliances, and manipulates circumstances to achieve his goals. His reputation in New York's criminal underworld is built on a foundation of brutal efficiency and cold logic. When someone attempts to assassinate him, he not only discovers the culprit, but uses the situation to gain control of 51% of the Teresi family's whiskey and drug operations, a move that demonstrates his ability to transform threats into opportunities. His business acumen is as sharp as his killer instinct. He increases his family's profits by 30% during his time in New York through a combination of strategic expansion and ruthless elimination of competition. The power dynamics between them shift constantly, creating a dangerous dance of attraction and resistance. When Crew kills Andrew, a man Rhea was dating, she is horrified, yet finds herself responding to Crew's forceful kiss moments later, a contradiction that haunts her. When he sends her an enormous sum of money after eliminating the Teresi family, she is simultaneously outraged by his methods and impressed by the financial independence it offers her. Once again, Crew is the common denominator in this chaos, she thinks, recognizing his influence over every aspect of her life. Their relationship raises uncomfortable questions about agency and consent in a world where power imbalances shape every interaction. Does Rhea truly have a choice when Crew eliminates all other options? Is her eventual surrender a defeat or a recognition of her own desires? The novel explores how power corrupts not just those who wield it, but those who resist it. Through their complicated dynamic, we see how power can be both a poison and an aphrodisiac, destroying boundaries while creating new forms of dependency. The story delves into the psychological cost of power, showing how it isolates both characters. Rhea's legal victories leave her increasingly disconnected from normal relationships, while Crew's dominance in the criminal world requires constant vigilance and emotional detachment. Their attraction to each other stems partly from this shared isolation. They recognize in each other the price they've paid for power. Throughout her life, Rhea has defined herself by what she runs from. At 16, she fled Italy to escape an arranged marriage. In New York, she built a life deliberately separate from her family's criminal enterprises. When Crew re-enters her life, her instinct is once again to run, changing hotels multiple times to avoid him, refusing to answer his messages, and physically fleeing whenever they encounter each other. This pattern of avoidance extends beyond her relationship with Crew to her broader identity. Despite working as a criminal defense attorney representing clients like the Teresi family, Rhea maintains the illusion that she has escaped her criminal heritage. When Angel points out this contradiction, You're a criminal defense lawyer. You haven't strayed far from our world. Rhea is forced to confront the fact that she has never truly escaped her past, merely found a more socially acceptable way to engage with it. Her friend Monica identifies this tendency directly. You always run when things get tough. This observation cuts to the heart of Rhea's character. Despite her fierce competence in the courtroom, where she never backs down from a challenge, she consistently avoids emotional confrontations and difficult truths about herself. When Crew arranges their wedding without her consent and she shoots him in the leg to escape, it represents the culmination of this pattern, a literal flight from commitment. Yet this act also marks a turning point. For the first time, Rhea is forced to examine why she runs and what she truly wants. "I've been blaming Crew for everything, but didn't I participate too?" she reflects. "Despite claiming to hate him, I can't deny the excitement of our time together. The moments on the couch, the phenomenal sex, his possessive nature." This realization leads to her most profound insight. "Angel's suggestion that I'm running away opened my eyes. I never run from anything in the courtroom, so why is it different with Crew?" Both Crew and Rhea present different faces to the world than they show to each other. Crew is known as a ruthless crime lord who kills without remorse and demands absolute loyalty. His reputation in Chicago's underworld is built on calculated violence and an iron grip on his territory. Associates speak of his cold efficiency in eliminating threats, while rivals fear his unpredictable nature. Yet with Rhea, he reveals vulnerability and even tenderness that no one else witnesses. In quiet moments at his penthouse, his carefully constructed walls crumble. He touches her with gentle hands that hours earlier might have ordered a hit. When his brother mentions that he seems less stressed after being with her, Crew acknowledges her unique effect on him, admitting for the first time that someone has penetrated his armor. Similarly, Rhea projects an image of cool competence and independence to the world. In the courtroom, she is formidable and controlled, never revealing the inner turmoil that characterizes her personal life. Her colleagues know her as the Ice Queen prosecutor, who never loses her composure, even in the most challenging cases. She maintains a careful distance from office politics and personal entanglements. Even with friends like Angel, she maintains that her relationship with Crew is just sex and that she's gotten him out of her system, lies she tells herself as much as others. Her carefully crafted persona begins to crack only in private moments when memories of Crew's touch leave her trembling and uncertain. These masks become increasingly difficult to maintain as their relationship intensifies. During an engagement party for Crew and Rhea's sister Honey, whom Crew agrees to marry after failing to secure Rhea, their true feelings become impossible to hide. The opulent ballroom becomes a stage for their unspoken drama. Crew can barely tear his eyes away from Rhea despite standing beside his fiancée, while Rhea finds herself jealous and heartbroken despite having rejected him. The champagne flows freely, but neither can taste anything beyond their own bitter regret. In a pivotal scene in the library, their masks finally slip completely. The wood-paneled room becomes both sanctuary and confrontation space as years of pretense fall away. When Rhea coldly asks if he slept with Honey, her voice carrying all the sharp edges of her courthouse persona, Crew responds with brutal honesty. "You're the only one I think about." The words hang in the air between them, heavy with truth. For perhaps the first time, they speak to each other without pretense or manipulation, revealing the raw truth of their feelings. When Rhea unexpectedly begins to cry, tears in her eyes instead of the calculated anger I expected, as Prue observes, it represents a fundamental shift in their dynamic. The vulnerability they've both fought so hard to conceal becomes the bridge that ultimately connects them. In this moment, surrounded by leather-bound books and shadows, they finally see each other clearly, not as the masks they wear, but as the people they truly are. The novel reaches its climax when Rhea, having decided she cannot attend Crew's wedding to her sister, retreats to her family's lake house. When Crew finds her there and announces that the wedding is canceled because you're the one I want, they finally surrender to their feelings for each other. The realization hits me hard. I love him, and I hate him too, Rhea acknowledges, finally accepting the contradiction at the heart of their relationship. When Crew says, I love you, Miss Ritchie, and she responds, I think I love you too, it represents not just a romantic resolution, but an acceptance of their complex, often troubling dynamic. What makes this ending particularly interesting is that neither character fundamentally changes. Crew remains possessive and controlling, while Rhea maintains her defiant spirit. Rather than transforming for love, they negotiate terms that allow them to be together while honoring their essential natures. This negotiation takes literal form in a contract Rhea drafts after accepting Crew's proposal. She agrees to take his name, but threatens infidelity if he betrays her. She refuses to promise children, forcing Crew to choose between her and his need for an heir. She insists on keeping her apartment as a retreat when he becomes too authoritarian, acknowledging that his controlling nature will not disappear. For his part, Crew accepts most of her terms while maintaining his core identity. When she asks what his men will call her now, he responds that she'll be revered as his queen, but warns that anyone who approaches her without his permission will end up dead, a reminder that marriage hasn't softened his violent nature. Their wedding represents not a conventional happy ending, but an acceptance of each other's darkness. As Rhea walks down the aisle, Crew whispers, "Ready to give me your lethal vows, wife?" An acknowledgement that their union is sealed not just with love, but with the potential for destruction that has characterized their relationship from the beginning. As Rhea and Crew exchange their lethal vows, the novel leaves readers with profound questions about choice, destiny, and the nature of love. Has Rhea simply fulfilled the fate she tried so hard to escape? Or has she reclaimed agency by choosing Crew on her own terms? Is their love redemptive or destructive, or somehow both simultaneously? These questions echo throughout the final chapters as readers witness the culmination of their complex journey from enemies to lovers to something entirely unprecedented in the genre. The complexity of these questions reflects the novel's nuanced exploration of morally ambiguous characters and relationships. Neither Rhea nor Crew can be easily categorized as heroes or villains. They exist in the gray area where human desire, ambition, and vulnerability intersect with violence, manipulation, and power. Crew's ruthless business dealings and territorial nature contrast sharply with his genuine vulnerability when it comes to Rhea, while her fierce independence and calculated manipulations are softened by moments of raw emotional honesty. Perhaps the most compelling aspect of their story is how it challenges conventional narratives about love and transformation. Crew doesn't become a better man because of his love for Rhea, nor does she tame her wild spirit to accommodate his controlling nature. Instead, they forge a relationship that acknowledges and even celebrates their flaws and contradictions. Their dynamic remains electric and dangerous, marked by heated arguments, passionate reconciliations, and an underlying current of potential violence that neither tries to deny. I've ended up exactly where I once fled from, beside one of the world's most dangerous men, possessive, controlling, a complete jerk, Rhea reflects on her wedding day. But I'm determined not to let Crew walk all over me. This determination, coupled with her newfound acceptance of her feelings for him, suggests that their future will be as tumultuous as their past, filled with power struggles, passion, and the constant negotiation of boundaries. Their relationship demonstrates that love doesn't necessarily mean compromise or change, but rather finding someone who accepts and matches your particular brand of chaos. The novel's closing scenes reinforce this theme through subtle callbacks to earlier conflicts. When Crew presents Rhea with her wedding gift, a corporation of her own to run, it symbolizes both his acceptance of her ambition and his understanding that true partnership means supporting rather than suppressing each other's nature. Similarly, Rhea's decision to maintain her separate apartment while moving into Crew's penthouse speaks to their mutual understanding that space and independence are as crucial to their relationship as their intense connection. In the end, Lethal Vows offers not a fairy tale, but a compelling exploration of how two deeply flawed individuals might find completion in each other precisely because they recognize and accept each other's darkness. Their love doesn't conquer all. It simply creates a space where they can be fully themselves, for better or worse. And perhaps that's the most honest kind of love story of all. One that acknowledges that true partnership isn't about changing each other, but about finding strength in their shared complexities and contradictions.